Welcome to the Revolutionary Action Dance Party. I'm Pierre Loiselle. On November 6, 2000, Dr. Roland Christjohn spoke at St. Thomas University. His talk, Racism as an Institutional Phenomenon, The Canadian Experience, outlines the Canadian government's take on racism and exposes the ideology which supports the continuing existence of racism. Furthermore, he provides a historical analysis of the political economy of racism towards Indigenous people in the Americas, the theft of their land, and the destruction of their political, economic, and cultural sovereignty. Dr. Roland Christjohn, the Director of Native Studies at St. Thomas University, is co-author of The Circle Game, Shadows and Substance in the Indian Residential School Experience in Canada. An Oneida of the Iroquois Confederacy, he has had long experience and has written extensively about social issues which affect Indigenous peoples of North America. Please stay tuned for Dr. Roland Christjohn, Racism as an Institutional Phenomena, The Canadian Experience, coming up on this edition of the Revolutionary Action Dance Party.
The Iroquois consider clapping impolite. Just thought I would let you know that. My topic tonight is institutional racism and institutional racism in Canada. Frankly, the first real job that I ever had once I got out of university was one of the parts of my job description was to go around and give talks, not generally to groups this size, more mainly about 15 or 20 people, trying to convince them that Indians weren't the degenerate monsters that they seemed to believe that we were. This was back in the early 1970s. And my interest in institutional racism developed out of that time because very quickly I got the notion that I was absolutely wasting my time in going out and giving those talks, that I was having absolutely no impact whatsoever. If the people were already convinced that I was a degenerate good-for-nothing, then they remained convinced that I was one after my talk. And if they were well-disposed toward Indian people at the beginning, I didn't do anything to disrupt them of that. And if they were neutral, well, they might very well go either way. But as an issue of polarization, there weren't that many people in the third category. So I spent a lot of my time, first of all, wondering why was I not having that impact, and secondly, well, trying to find reasons for my own inadequacies why I wasn't having that impact. But much later, trying to wonder maybe it was something more than just what's happening to me. Maybe I was dealing with racism at a different level. And another strand in this interest that I have in racism and institutional racism was the fact that my graduate coursework was all conducted at University of Western Ontario, and where the infamous J. Philippe Rushton was on faculty. He wasn't only on faculty, he was actually on my doctoral committee. And Phil and I used to go out for dinner in the evenings. We were both workaholics in those days, and we would walk over to the medical school cafeteria, which was the only decent food on campus, after about 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening. And it was an experience. Phil finally learned not to argue with me, and on that basis, even I try to tell people, I get along with everybody. If I can have dinner on a regular basis with Phil Rushton, who could I not put up with? But it was because of that kind of experience, when I was finishing up my doctorate, I actually put in for a postdoc at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign to study institutional racism with Jerry Hirsch. He had, at the time, the only formal program in the investigation of institutional racism in North America. And I was hedging my bets, you know. You're working on your doctorate, you're about to get it, maybe you're going to get a job, maybe you're not. Why don't you put in for a postdoc, and who knows? I got the postdoc, but I did not take it because I actually took a position elsewhere. I said in my own mind that, well, eventually I'll be able to go and take it once the opportunity arises in future years. What I didn't realize, of course, is that was right at the time where Ronald Reagan finally came into power. And one of the first things that he did in the United States to academia was to remove all the programs on racism, institutional and otherwise. So I might have had a chance to do some advanced study there, on that topic back in the early 1980s, but that opportunity no longer exists. The program's not there anymore. And I guess a third strand concerning tonight's talk was the fact that I have written and presented extensively on it, on racism. One of my last papers, actually the kind of thing that I'm updating for tonight's talk, is the quincentenary address that I gave during the Columbus quincentenary year on institutional racism in North America. And I had originally intended to include that in my book on residential schooling as an additional appendix. The difficulty, as far as I was concerned, was that it was being overly redundant. I mean, when I read my own work, all I see is that I'm saying the same thing over and over again, and you people might get exactly the same impression tonight, that here's Roland going off again, saying the same old thing. My problem is that I end up having to repeat myself because people don't seem to take it seriously. What seems to me to be a rather easy generalization to make from a rather small number of underlying principles concerning the treatment of First Nations people, Indigenous people in Canada, that is always particularized by the audience that's listening to me, particularly if they're if they're very strongly interested in particularizing it. So when I talk about residential schools, well, they want to hear about residential schools, but they do not see that the kind of analysis that I'm doing has generalization to such things as First Nations suicide, to alcohol and drug abuse in Aboriginal communities, and so on. I always think it's a rather easy generalization to make, that the principles that I'm establishing here, the kind of analysis I'm doing here, see how easy it is to apply it to these other areas. And instead I get, time and time again, people prove that if they can make that generalization, they don't want to make it. That they want to see the problems of, let's say, educational difficulties in First Nations country areas and suicide and whatever are all specific and particular and don't have any kind of unifying underlying theme. And so I left the notion of racism out of that, thinking that I had already done that to death, only to be told in various ways that that kind of analysis is still lacking from public consciousness. An invitation to participate in the a regional conference on racism. Maybe some of you know that there's to be an international conference, the World Conference Against Racism. World Conference Against Racism is to be held, I believe, in August and September of the coming year. Canada is playing a fairly prominent role in that, and as part of the run-up to the preparation of Canada's presentation, they've been holding a series of regional meetings. One of the regional meetings they held was in Halifax in September, and I was invited to that. They've had one, before they had the one in Halifax, they had one in Vancouver, and they had one in Edmonton. After Halifax, they were going to Montreal and Toronto, and then somewhere in the Northwest Territories, I think probably Yellowknife, but I can't remember precisely where it is. The idea was that there would be participation of anybody who had anything interesting to say, apparently, on racism in Canada at these local consultations. And that the information obtained at these local consultations would somehow be worked into the Canadian submission. And so I was invited to that. And actually quite a few members of St. Thomas University faculty were invited to that. I saw other of my colleagues there. But among the things they sent you to participate is this draft discussion paper, where the idea was to sort of like limit or focus the attention of participants along certain lines that would help Canada in its preparation. What was appalling to me was as soon as I got three pages into the paperwork, and the paperwork that I've showed you is only a little part of it, they actually send you something about that thick. I get three pages into it and I realized that the Canadian government as a whole has absolutely no grasp of the issues. That their presentation at this World Conference Against Racism, if it's going to follow along the lines of their draft presentation, is going to be the same kind of gibberish that I argue is Canada's response to its role in the residential schools, for example. That the same missing part of the analysis in exactly the same ideological ways that it's missing from an honest response to the residential schools is also missing from what is supposed to be the Canadian response to racism in Canada. And consequently, I spent most of my time at that conference trying to convince the people in my workshop session, as a First Nations person, of course, I was stuck with the Aboriginal peoples. We had our own little room where we could talk to ourselves. trying to convince them that we wanted absolutely no part of answering these questions or meeting the guidelines that were set out in the materials that was sent to us. Fortunately for me, nobody else had read their material. And so consequently, I was pretty well able to convince everyone that what we needed to do was to repudiate the process and instead start work on trying to develop direct Indigenous groups' presentation over and above whatever Canada wished to include concerning its presentation at that conference. And in far too many ways, my experience has been that Canada is able to present a particular picture of its interactions with Indigenous peoples by virtue of the fact that we're not there to contradict it. A case that comes to mind is a friend of mine who is a linguist and language instructor who just happened to be wandering through Geneva one day when she heard a conversation going on where Canada was talking about its wonderful First Nations language policies. And she broke into the meeting and sort of took it over at voice point because she talks a lot better than I do in terms of her public speaking voice. And I'd say that was, but for that incident, the rest of the world would have thought that Canada is doing wonderful things in virtue of First Nations languages. But that was serendipitous. Here we know that we have more than a year's lead time. I knew about the World Conference Against Racism quite some time before I was invited to participate in that local consultation. So we've had more than a year's lead time, and my question is, to what extent are we actually working on meaningful alternatives to the kind of program that the Canadian government was insinuating by virtue of the kinds of organizations that it was approaching, by virtue of the kinds of questions that were being asked? And so it was after that conference that I actually began seriously updating my 1992 paper with the idea that, well, eventually, sooner or later, somebody may ask for this, and rather than just sort of have to give them an off-the-cuff explanation of my objections to Canada's approach to racism, that I would try to be as fully prepared as possible. Well, that if you take the draft of the World Conference Against Racism, Canada's position seriously, that we have to seriously question that. I think we have to start as to talking, what is institutional racism? Back in my day, back when I was a whippersnapper, what institutional racism actually consisted of was the investigation of obvious disparities in outcomes, institutionally based outcomes. So for example, in the United States, the black incarceration rate, the detailing of a black incarceration rate, would be considered prima facie evidence for some kind of an institutional bias in the law enforcement or justice systems. The fact that, what they say, one in three black persons in the United States is actually enfranchised from voting in tomorrow's election by virtue of the fact that they were federally incarcerated at some time, so they're no longer allowed to have the voting franchise. That kind of gathering of such kinds of statistics involves the process of a demonstration of institutional racism. In Canada, the investigation of institutional racism might look at the high school failure rates for First Nations people versus non-First Nations people. An investigation might look at the suicide rate, the fact that it's, for some age groups anyway, five times higher for Indigenous peoples than it is for non-Indigenous peoples, would be taken perhaps as a grounds for making a case that there's something institutionally wrong with the mental health services. In New Brunswick, charting on a map the location of the dump sites, or the proposed dump sites, waste disposal sites, in relation to First Nations community in New Brunswick might be a way of institutionally demonstrating that, gee, isn't it off? Are we to take this as a coincidence that, you know, they're throwing darts at a map of New Brunswick as to where to put these waste disposal sites, and for some reason they're all bordering on First Nations lands of some sort, that an institutional racism analysis would be trying to uncover that kind of information to make a case that something more than individual prejudices were operating. Sivanandan has a definition of institutional racism that I will cite. By the way, I like a lot of his work. He's at the Institute for Study of Race Relations in London, England, and he's written extensively on institutional racism over the years, and I've always found his work quite informative. But he defines institutional racism rather blandly, I think. Institutional racism is that which, covertly or overtly, resides in the policies, procedures, operations, and culture of public or private institutions, reinforcing individual prejudices and being reinforced by them in turn. What institutional racism does is try to draw a distinction that there are at least two different kinds of racism. The racism that might be exemplified in the minds and the words and the deeds of members of the Ku Klux Klan. Blacks are all inferior beings that need to be shipped back to Africa and so on. So it's a prejudicial attitude of some sort. Versus the kind of racism that is simply apparent in the institutional and social fabric that has arisen in a country at a particular time. That might be exemplified as, for example, in the Ontario Hydro policy until 1965, that First Nations people not be allowed to have jobs. If you're an Indian person and you don't want to work for Ontario Hydro in 1964, there was absolutely no chance that you were going to get a job. It was a policy that you couldn't work for Ontario Hydro. And note what the difference is that if you believe only in individual racism, then what you're believing is that the person who turned you down for that job at Ontario Hydro doesn't like Indians. Whereas if you also include the idea of institutional racism, then what you have to say is you actually have no idea what was going on in the mind of the person who turned you down for that job. He may have liked Indians personally, he may have disliked Indians personally. He may have been completely indifferent to Indians. The fact of the matter was is that his turning you down was an institutional matter and not a personal one. And consequently, you have to draw a distinction, according to this view of institutional racism, between the a personal form of individual prejudice versus an institutional form of systematic discrimination or prejudicial treatment. Now, I've always had a problem with that. Not that I don't think that there's a distinction to be made there, but that the distinction is, in a lot of ways, a dangerous one to make, in my opinion. The first difficulty that I always have seen with drawing a distinction between the individual racism and institutional racism is that talking about it in terms of institutional racism seems to give a natural intervention strategy. One of the things that you're doing, again, studying in institutional racism is you're trying to show that fewer black people are in these kinds of jobs, or that more First Nations people are in the prison population, or that fewer women are doing this particular kind of work, and so on. Once you've pointed that out, the remedy seems to be, well, then what you need to do is to have more of whatever the oppressed group is in those kinds of positions. So that if you reduce the number of Indians in the prison system, well, then you have taken institutional racism out of the prison system. If more First Nations people graduate from high school, then you have resolved the difficulty, the institutional racist difficulties of the educational system. To me, that doesn't follow, because when you say, gee, maybe the National Hockey League is a sexist organization, but will sexism in Canada be remediated once half of the players in the National Hockey League are women? I don't think so. I think that you won't necessarily fall into that kind of thinking, but it's a very slippery slope, and it's a very, very easy one to fall into. That, since this exemplifies what the difficulty is, then the remediation of that difficulty is a response to that difficulty. It is an intervention within that difficulty. And a lot of times it isn't. For one thing, it leaves unexamined the systemic nature of how that got there in the first place. It takes the status quo for granted. That if, let's say, that the National Hockey League is an exemplification of violence and male machismo or whatever, then the solution is for women to become more violently male machismic of some sort. Once women talk that way and beat people over the head with sticks and can curse and scratch themselves like everybody else, then we'll have true equality. And then what we've got then is a race to the bottom, as far as I can see, in terms of what we take as a standard for human conduct. What's missing there is, again, the analysis of the underlying system that it is that you're objecting to. It's very easy, and as a matter of fact, I will show you very shortly that Canada makes this leap itself to relate the inequities on the field of play that they see as a requirement to level the playing field. Ah, there aren't enough Indians in this particular game. Let's get a few more Indians in this game. And once there are more Indians in this game, then we can say, this game is fair. And all I can say is, if you don't want to play that game, then being let in, particularly in the fourth quarter and 300 points down, is not fair play. What you have to be able to say is, I have a right not to go walking out on that field. I have a right to play a different game. We did play a different game. It was called the Iroquois way, or it was called the Maliseet way, or it was called the Cree way. And whatever it wasn't that particular game. The world will not become a better place when we're all equally despoilers of this planet. That if we've got a different way of relating to nature or relating to other human beings and so on, we are entitled to it by virtue of the fact that we are people too. And it's not an advance to say it's fair if everybody gets to play by that person's rules or that particular group's rules. That's all missing in this in that particular notion. A second difficulty that I've always had with racism, I have to get personal again here. My basic introduction to notions of racism in a formal sense were conducted under Leonard Lieberman. And if any of you are familiar with Leonard Lieberman's work, he's a student of Ashley Montague. So I always like to say, indirectly, I'm a student once removed of Ashley Montague. I do not believe in the concept of race. I've looked at the information upside and backwards and inside out from physical anthropological perspectives, from biological perspectives, and from psychological perspectives. There is nothing that demonstrates that there are different races of human beings with different capacities. The fact that a lot of people find it convenient to put that out, like I mentioned before, one of my instructors, Bill Rushton, finds it awfully easy to talk about the black race or the Asian race or the white race or whatever, as if that was a coherent, identifiable, genetically meaningful, biologically meaningful distinction. That is a presumption I'm not willing to give them. And like I say, the information on that, if anybody doubts that, go back to the work of Ashley Montague. Ashley Montague was arguing back in the 40s. And the official United Nations positions on statements on race is that there is no such biological entity. And I would even go further. I also distrust the notion of talking about race as a social construct of some sort. Because it's very easy to move from that and saying, well, it's not a matter of whether or not actually there is a biological thing as race. People are still willing to treat it as if it's race, so we can go on from there. And so I run into a lot of people who tell me that they agree that there is no biological basis for making that distinction, but then we'll go on and conduct that research anyway. And like I say, I find that a slippery slope also. I think that we have to talk about the dynamics of male versus female, of black versus white, of indigenous people versus non-indigenous people, not only in North America and South America, but throughout the world. Not in terms of the characteristics of their skin color or their eye shape or whatever, but in entirely different terms, which are not included. That's actually all becomes impossible to approach once you take as the underlying kernel of what you're talking about to be a biological or a social distinction of some sort. But something a lot more important and subtle is going on than that. That leads me to a little anecdote. A friend of mine who gave some lectures here, Paul Williams, who's a lawyer, was asked And by the way, let me just throw this in. Paul Williams was not born of Iroquois parentage. His parents are not Iroquois. And yet if you ask me if Paul Williams is an Iroquois, I say yes, because he was formally adopted according to the Iroquois traditions. He's a member of his own particular longhouse. And as far as I'm concerned, that's what distinguishes an Iroquois from a non-Iroquois. And if the Onondaga at Six Nations consider Paul Onondaga enough, then I'm not going to argue with them. That's their business to make that declaration, not mine. And as such, I accept Paul totally, entirely as an Iroquois person. There is no basis in Iroquois law, in the great law of the Confederacy, of talking about persons' membership in the Confederacy or not on the basis of putative racial characteristics. That is nowhere in the great law that you have to have these particular characteristics. Which leads me to my anecdote. He was actually approached by one of the Iroquois reserves to write out a race-based definition of an Iroquois person that they wanted to include in a series of motions and implement within the longhouse. And Paul has more of a sense of humor than's good for a lawyer, I think. He went out and he actually wrote them up and he came back and handed it to them and passed it around the longhouse, and people started reading and they said, "What the hell is this? You said, specified that you have to have dental x-rays, that it's going to determine whether or not their molars have five roots, whether or not they have shovel incisors, whether or not they can point to members of their immediate family with the Mongolian spots on their backsides." What the hell is this? And Paul says, those are the distinguishing characteristics of First Nations populations. We have shovel incisors, we have five roots to our molars, and by the way, those of you who've gone to the dentist and the dentists who only think there are four molars, you know exactly what I'm talking about. They often leave one in, and they have to be reminded. There's another one to go in there and get. Thank you very much. That Paul says, if you mean to work out a racial test for an Indians, there it is. They said, well, we thought it would be something else. And he said, well, best estimates are that 98% of human genetic material is in common with chimpanzees. Are you saying that a chimpanzee is 98% Mohawk? They didn't like that at all. But again, it was the attitude of the oppressor that this race was a distinguishable, identifiable thing that somehow became, not somehow, it wasn't by accident, but it became imprinted as part of what was taken to be the traditional bases of membership in the Iroquois Confederacy. Paul parodied that for them. They have since withdrawn that particular interest, not because I think they've given up on it, but because they're trying to find somebody who's going to come up with a nice, simpler test than Paul was able to specify for them. But again, I have to reiterate, and I'll come back to this theme at the end one more time, and that is, it's a very dangerous thing to equate what being a First Nation person is with whose grandparents were. That leads us into an abyss that we haven't really thought of very, very carefully, and that we should think of before we take another step down that road. But overall, what that means to me is that in terms of investigation of institutional racism, that's not how I want to go. I don't want to accept, even for a hypothetical moment, that racism, well, it might be a socially constructed category or whatever, but let's go on from there. Let's not deal with it. It is an issue that has to be dealt with, and it's not dealt with under the term specified there. What I'm running into, or what I'm trying to talk about, is the tension that the concept of institutional racism brings in between racism as an institutional phenomenon and racism as an individual phenomenon. And here I find I must revert to the old Christian, he's at it again, telling the same old story over and over again tactic, and that is that this distinction between the individual and the social, or between the individual and the collective, or between the person and the situation and so on, all of those kinds of distinctions, and the muddles that we get around those distinctions are based on an ideological game that is played on First Nations people, other indigenous people all around the world, even on oppressors themselves, over and over again. And it is a philosophical system that's not very well studied. It's not very thoroughly studied. It's a philosophical system known as methodological individualism. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on that because it's a big long word and it makes my tongue hurt. But the basic notion is that in order to find something to follow something down to its basic, most bedrock level of explanation and understanding, it must be reduced to the level of individuals. So what it means to be a First Nations person, according to this, is that we have particular genetic material. Or if we want to deal with it psychologically, that it means First Nations people have particular traits, or they have particular personality characteristics, or they have a particularly distinct value system, and that those traits and value systems or whatever's give rise to the social institutional structure that defines Iroquois society, or Cree society, or mainstream society for that case. The idea is that it's basically a reductionist of some sort, that what is apparent and social and visible and manifest really has its explanation in what is latent and hidden and underlying and often quite dynamic. And I mean by dynamic in that it works in mysterious ways. Sometimes it's there and sometimes it's not. And depending on whether or not you want to invoke it, depends on the explanatory contingencies that arise in a particular situation. Simple example of that. I mean, what is the real objection to a level playing field? I mean, what is the refutation of saying, there are more Indians in prison than non-Indians, proportionally speaking? That is a demonstration of racism then. There's something racially wrong with the justice system and the law enforcement system. There are fewer Indians graduating from high school than non-Indians, then there must be something wrong with the educational system as constituted. And while that seems like a relatively straightforward explanation, by the way, explanations that I agree with, what happens is that there's also another explanation which can't be ruled out, and which methodological individualism inclines us to accept over and over again without much comment. And that is, if there are more Indians, for example, in the prison system than non-Indians in the prison system, proportionally speaking, it's because there's something criminally wrong with the Indians. If Indians are committing suicide more frequently than non-Indians are committing suicide, it's got nothing to do wrong with the system or the society. It's got everything to do with something wrong with the Indians. If Indians drink more, if there are more Indian drunks and more Indian drug abusers than non-Indians, then the problem is that there's something wrong with the Indians. They've got the gene for drunkenness, or they've got the gene for suicide. There's supposedly a suicide gene out there now, too. They've got the gene for suicide, or we've got that gene for criminal violence. And when you think about it, the popularity of explanations along the lines that Phil Rushton suggests that when people are now confronted with evidence of systemic institutional racism, it doesn't need necessarily lead to a systemic institutional analysis. It just as easily runs into a victim-blaming, personal, internal, individual explanatory framework for deciding that something's wrong. And what do we find as a result of those kinds of explanatory schemes? You find the same difficulty, as I mentioned earlier, in that it provides people making those analyses with a supposed intervention method of dealing with it. So Indians are stupider than everybody else. That explains why Indians aren't doing very well in high school or in university. If Indians are stupider than everybody else, then we should probably modify our expectations with respect to what we can really get out of an Indian in a school system. Certainly post-secondarily, what we should be looking to do is to make sure that the Indians aren't pushed too much with respect to assignments and coursework and particular programs of study. Now, if you think that's a ridiculous kind of tack to take, you should realize that it's a tack taken over and over again. Back in the early 1980s, the province of Saskatchewan came within the breadth of a hair of adopting for the entire province a right-brain curriculum. And according to this right-brain curriculum theory, it was the fact of the matter that Indians simply weren't any good at mathematics. They simply weren't any good at logical, rational thinking. That they were so good with their hands, and that the coursework should be largely around finger painting and holding up a shovel, but you certainly wouldn't require Indians to do things like homework or math or writing out assignments. That would be as cruel as having one-armed children do push-ups. That there was this natural inadequacy on the part of the Indians that the humane thing to do was to take that into account and to revise your expectations in a particular way. The entire province of Saskatchewan, like I say, came within an inch of doing that. And I'll take some credit for it. I remember I was mad as the all get out at that time, and that I and a couple of my colleagues wrote papers at that point disputing all of the evidence. Because there's absolutely no basis for that. As natural as that explanation may sound, particularly to psychologists like myself, we're always giving people tests and guessing about what's going on north of individual people's necks. The difficulty is that the inferential network in order that permits you to make those kinds of inferences is extremely complicated. And it's a test that none of these instruments that have made grand pronouncements concerning the capacities or incapacities of different minority peoples, including First Nations people, that none of those tests have ever passed. And consequently, it is a matter of ethics and immorality and racism simply to give the tests, assume that they're going to work in the same way with Indians and non-Indians, and then start making pronouncement that, okay, yeah, a lot of Indians are dropping out, and while some people might think that it's because there's something wrong with the educational system, we know it's really because there's something drastically wrong with First Nations people. Here you have the insinuation of a personal, internal, individual explanation, where literally it's the case where you don't have the means for deciding between an institutional base and a personal base explanation for the same fact. We have a society, a mainstream society, that's dedicated to the notion of finding personal, internal, and individual explanations for why things are the way that they are. A lot more brighter people than I have written about them. William Ryan's book on equality, for example, is an extremely clear point-by-point delineation of how that mentality insinuates itself, how that ideology insinuates itself in Western thinking. And like I said, I've been writing on William Ryan's coattails on this kind of analysis for years. I always thank goodness that I don't have to make these kinds of arguments from scratch myself, because they've already been made by people who've been at that work a lot longer than I have. The fact that they've been marginalized in mainstream academic thought is not so much an accident as another indication of pre-existing institutional biases to see the world operating according to particular norms. There's a whole history of that ideology which comes down to us nowadays, sometimes called the meritocracy. And a lot of people don't know the origin of the word meritocracy, but it was a made-up word. It was made up by a fellow by the name of Young. He wrote a parody about education. And what he was trying to demonstrate was that powers that be in the time that he was writing had to have some kind of way of getting people to cooperate in their own marginalization. A point that I try to make over and over again. When I talk about the marginalization of First Nations people or black people or women, we have to realize that marginalization starts with the population of the country itself that does the marginalizing. The first victims of colonization is the country itself. It's only when it has its own population willing to accept disparities and excesses on certain parts and whatever, that they're able to branch out and begin imposing those same kind of disparities on other people. If you want to understand the history of English colonialism, start with England. Then move your way to Ireland, move your way to Wales, and move your way to Scotland. And after you've understood the subjugation of the British Isles, then start thinking about India, North America, Australia, and the rest of the world. That the acceptance of people to this inherent system of disparity is a built one, is a fabricated one that takes a long time to get to put into operation. Anyway, Young's parody on the meritocracy was that the meritocracy, he writes about it as if he's a sociologist doing an analysis of a situation that has existed and developed over a long period of time. And what he's saying is, well, they had the problem of trying to get the masses to accede to their own oppression, and the way they did it was by creating a mythology of a meritocracy that you get to where you were in their society by virtue of your own personal capacity. That if you were smart and you worked hard and you kept your nose clean, you would rise to your level of competence or level of your incompetence, and at that point you would stop. What Jung was trying to demonstrate was that people in position of power could maintain their position of power by only allowing certain people to certain levels within the levers of society, and creating this myth of a meritocracy to justify it, what he thought of as being a parody, a lot of people have taken seriously. And so you see people in the United States like Herrnstein writing about the meritocracy as, well, if blacks aren't doing very well in education, it's because they merit that situation. See how easy it is to start talking about a systemic failure of some sort, but in saying, well, if you merit that, if you have your own capacity, if you're really smart enough, they don't really care how black you are or how white you are. If you're smart enough, you'll go this far, and if you're not smart enough, you're not going to go that far. So you get the entire insinuation of the meritocracy as being the proper system that actually operates. We have the same thing in Canada. People like, I don't know how many umpteenth times I've heard people talk about how important education is for First Nations people. And I like to believe it myself. I mean, I am at an educational institution, and I do try to take as many pains as possible to educate the students who bother to show up. But the bottom line is that I realized a long time ago that the marginalization of the First Nations people had less to do with their education and a lot more to do with other forces in society that weren't being analyzed at all. A simple example of that was my work on with the Williams Lake Tribal Council, seven different groups out at Caribou Tribal Council, who were investigating the lasting effects of residential school on their own children, now grown up. And one thing they wanted to look at was how the education dealt with the economic well-being of their populace. Their theory was that since residential schools weren't about education, and most of the people didn't get past grade 6 or grade 8 in residential schools, that there would be this large disparity in incomes between the people who went to residential schools and those who'd gone to provincial day schools instead, since they would really be getting an education at the provincial day schools. My only problem was, is from all the data that we obtained, and we did the largest survey on characteristics of residential school people, is that we couldn't find a difference in terms of income or location in the hierarchy of jobs between people who went to residential school and people who did not. And the disparity for both groups was on average half the income of what non-native people were making in the Williams Lake region of British Columbia. So it didn't matter whether or not you went to 12 years of good provincial schooling or 6 years of bad residential schooling. You ended up making half of what a white person did economically if you lived in that region of British Columbia. There, the explanation that education makes the difference does not explain what's going on at all. But one of the things that I decided had to be brought out was the simple fact of the place of First Nations people in the Canadian political economy. And again, Sivananda has a little quote that I like. Today the color line is the poverty line, is the power line. That which establishes the connection between them is capitalism. That which perpetuates it is imperialism. And what I want to say is that a lot of people have the wrong idea of the history of racism. When you investigate the history of racism, you find some terribly interesting things. And that racism, in the Western European sense of racism, has a starting date. And it's 1492. But before 1492, there's no indication that racism, as has come down to us now, ever existed. Not in Northern Europe, anyway. Northern or Mediterranean Europe. Now that sounds astonishing, because a lot of people think, well, wasn't the distinction always there to be seen? Wasn't it always there to be made? But if you check, and there are some very good historians on this, John Carew, Basil Davidson, one of my favorites is Ronald Saunders, Lost Tribes and Promised Land, The History of Racism in the Americas. A terrific book, because they say, well, while there were obvious disparities and there were some religious differences and whatever, you don't see racism the way we talk and think about racism today until Columbus shows up, and now they're guessing what's nowadays Haiti. And Columbus shows up and sticks his flag into the ground. Western racism can be dated from that particular moment. And the argument is quite a simple one, that if you're going to assert that the land that you just ran into, which has fantastic resources, lots of open spaces, trees as far as you can see, as much water as you could possibly imagine, a lot of land already for agriculture. It's a lie that the First Nations in the New World were not agriculturalists. That if you see all of this, then the only way you can pretend that it's empty land, terra nullius under the European phrase, is to pretend that those creatures who are running up to you, giving you food, welcoming you, are not human beings. If they're not human beings, then they have no more right to this land, to those trees, and to those natural resources than moose do, or squirrels do, Rocky and Bullwinkle. That they might be more like mosquitoes, vermin to be gotten rid of in order to make this a reasonable place. But what Columbus ran into was very much an imperative to create the notion that what I'm doing, I'm not doing to people. What I'm taking does not belong to people. And what he was doing in North America, Central America, South America, he was also doing to Africa for slightly different reasons. Because if you're going to go to Africa and you're going to pick up slave ships loaded with thousands of people, and you're going to bring them back to work them to their death, then the only way you can do that and still consider yourself a reasonable human being and a reasonable Christian is to say, I'm not doing this to people. That these people are more like cows, oxes, asses, beasts of burden than they are human beings. That if you read the work of John Crew and Basil Davidson, you find out that very early on in Columbus's enterprise, you find that there's a trade triangle established. Leave Europe to go to Africa to pick up slaves, go across the ocean to drop the slaves off and load the new cargo, bring the new cargo across to make your profit in the old world. Trade triangle. Two areas of that triangle, the black slave trade and the exploitation, expropriation of First Nations in the New World, were predicated on the requirement that human beings not be regarded as human beings. There were economic reasons for the development of racism. Talking to Phil Rushton, I got time and time again the idea that Phil seemed to think that Columbus was some kind of a scientist, that when he showed up to the New World, he was genuinely scientifically puzzled as to whether or not these things were human beings. So it becomes a scientific consideration, doesn't it? We have to go into this and, well, let's not be hasty, you know, there's evidence one side or the other on this, which I say is nonsense. That Columbus's men had absolutely no difficulty in believing that the women on these Caribbean islands were actually human beings. No difficulty about that at all. And by the time the Europeans got around in 1550, after the argument between Sepulveda and De las Casas, to agreeing that Indians were actually human beings, the dispossession had already taken place. The institutional structures were already in place to continue the mass murder of First Nations people, North, South, and Central America. And that what you have is, it became an academic dispute. Oh, well, yes, they're really human beings. Right, well, they're really human beings. So what? We've already established the power relations necessary for us to divest them of their property and take whatever it is that we want of theirs. Now, the important thing that we have to remember for institutional racism in Canada is that while the rationale for treating black people as subhuman has changed since the time of the slave trade, that the rationale for treating Aboriginal people in Canada as subhuman remains exactly the same rationale today as it was 500 years ago. That Canada's enviable place, we constantly come in, number one, as the greatest place on the planet Earth to live. Canada's enviable place in that hierarchy of nations is predicated on the continued exploitation of First Nations lands, First Nations resources, First Nations lives. It's interesting, in what would be ordinarily taken to be a institutional racist analysis, that the number one position of Canada in the hierarchy of good places to live on the planet Earth would drop to 63rd if they were only considered First Nations people instead. So if you make a distinction between First Nations people in Canada and non-First Nations people living in Canada, the non-First Nations people living in Canada would be first, and the First Nations, Indigenous, Métis, Inuit people living in Canada would be 63rd, if not lower. There is a continuing requirement to misunderstand the dynamics of racism in Canada as an individual prejudice of some sort, and to maintain Canada's one program. Somebody was asking about me about that just today, that Canada's had all these different programs toward First Nations people. And I say, no, that's the difference between using a matchlock and a Gatling gun. That the policy has been the same policy, that you carry out that same policy, however, by slightly different tactics. The policy has been one of assimilation. That if we can remove First Nations people and Aboriginal people and Métis people and all of the Indigenous people so that they no longer identify themselves as First Nations people, they no longer stand up when they say, are there any Indigenous people here? If they no longer speak their languages, if they no longer follow their traditions, if they are ashamed to admit that their all-year-round tan is a feature of the biological clime that they live in and not a feature of having a tanning salon, a permanent pass to a tanning salon. Once they get to that situation, then Canada's in the free and clear about 70% or more of what is not Canada, which includes New Brunswick and three-quarters of British Columbia and the Northwest Territories and 90% of Quebec and 70% of Ontario and so on and so on and so on. That under Western laws of possession and legal dispossession, that most of Canada does not belong to Canada. Most of what Canadians want to hold as being their territory is not their territory. Hence, the Indian problem is not a problem of that we are a degenerate people, that we're a degenerate species, or that we're a cost or a burden on the hardworking and decent people of society. The problem is that we're here at all. And our very presence here is not only a continued warning that sooner or later somebody may catch on, but it's a continuing moral reminder to the people who know anything about it that Canada has absolutely no leg morally to stand on of its treatment of First Nations people. None whatsoever. So the policy of assimilation is to get us to get in on the game. What I want to conclude with, I guess, then, is what makes me outraged about this World Conference Against Racism. I can sum it up in two sentences from this document, although the whole document, if we wanted to spend world enough in time. And by the way, you can go to the internet if you want and download this and read it for yourself. You know, if you think I'm making this up, it's not true. You can find it for yourself. This broad discussion among and between groups and communities across the country, we hope, will produce consensus on what we need to do at home to ensure that no Canadian is denied the opportunity to contribute fully to society because of intolerance, discrimination, or racism. That's one sentence from there. A little bit later on they say, individuals are prevented from reaching their full potential and making their unique contributions to society because of racism and intolerance. Does that sound really that horrible? And my answer is, if it doesn't sound horrible to you, then we've got exactly what I call the problem of institutional racism. Because that's not an agenda for understanding. That is an agenda to continue the assimilationist attack. That the problem is that Indians aren't fully assimilated to Canadian society. Now, part of the problem is those Indians themselves, yeah, they're kind of stupid and they're kind of smelly and they don't tell time very well. And they're always out in those damn boats picking up lobsters. That's part of the problem. But the other problem is that even among us right-thinking people, there are a few of us who won't let them come to our schools and eat at our lunch counters and have jobs next to us and even marry our daughters and sons. That's what the problem is from a racism point of view. We have to find those people among our own population that aren't contributing to the racial assimilation of these First Nations people quickly enough, and we have to change their minds. And when that takes place, then we will have no racism in Canada. And I'll say you have one other thing when you have, by that criteria, no racism in Canada. You will have no Indians in Canada. And that's why I say this mentality that's reflected here has got nothing to do with solving the problems of racism. It's taking the concerted Canadian attack of racism, the assimilationist agenda of the Canadian government, to its fullest extent. What it is trying to tell the world is we're not assimilating the Indians fast enough, and part of the problem is our own problem. And what I'm saying is that's not the problem at all. The problem is that Indians are not allowed to be Indians in Canada, that we're too dangerous in that state. And that's why I was urging the First Nations people at that conference in Halifax, and while I continue to urge people elsewhere, that we have to make our own presentation on this. We can't allow Canada to insinuate what its agenda is. Because I don't know that it's lying so much as it can't understand the truth. It seems to believe that since so many people in this world are hiding in storage carts and walking across the Arctic and whatever to get into Canada to become Canadians, that must be the most wonderful thing in the world, that everybody really wants to be that way. So the Indians must want it too, right? And look at them. We want them to be, look, just stop talking about the treaties and stuff and we'll let you come to our schools. Stop making trouble about the lobster things and we'll give you a few jobs in the lobster hatchery. Stop doing all of that stuff and things will be hunky-dory. But stopping doing that means, like I say, that there won't be any Indians. And this is why I have to say that it's not a matter of racism. It's not a matter of race. It's a matter of our behavior. That to be an Iroquois, let me tell you a little thing about Iroquois. Men in the Iroquois Confederacy are not born into the Iroquois Confederacy. Women are, they're considered superior mentally to men in our own ideological system. A newborn girl immediately becomes an Iroquois person. Iroquois men don't become Iroquois persons until they're 14 or 15 years old. Because we're considered too flighty, too emotional. We're not logical enough. We don't see the wonders of the Iroquois Confederacy right off. And it isn't until, like I say, we're 14 or 15 years old that we're even asked the question, have you heard the great law? Do you understand the great law? Do you undertake to live according to the best of your abilities according to that law? Because once you've done that, you're an Iroquois. We get our real grown-up adult name at that point and our world changes. But it has to be a voluntary decision, a reasoned decision based on our examination of it. That makes us an Iroquois person. It's got nothing to do who your parents or your grandparents were. It has everything to do with how you're going to behave. How are you going to walk in this world? How are you going to treat other people? And historically speaking, it didn't matter what your race is. If you show that you could walk the walk and talk the talk, you were an Iroquois person. That's what defined you as an Iroquois person, not your racial background. We are falling into the abyss if we believe that race determines who it is that we are, that somehow our cultural practices are encoded in our genetic material. Like I say, that means that 98% of chimpanzees are Indians too, because they have the same 98% of our genetic material, and it involves a complacency of some sort. We can put aside our practices, we can put aside our languages, we can put aside how it is that we are supposed to relate to one another and to the universe and to nature. We can put aside all of that because it's just in our genes. Let's not worry about learning our languages. Let's not worry about maintaining our religious and cultural institutions. Let's not worry about maintaining the longhouse and the song and the old ways. None of that's necessary because, you know, genetically it'll be in our skin color and in the shape of our teeth. And I say that's nonsense. That it comes down to practice. And that's what's being denied us, the right to practice in this world what it is that defines us the way that we are. The reason why, I'll be very clear on that. It's political and it's economic. It's got everything to do with the assimilationist agenda of demonstrating to the rest of the world, well, we did our best by the Indians, but they're not here anymore. So we don't have to worry about who really owns New Brunswick or who really owns Nova Scotia or British Columbia. Nobody has to worry about who you have to pay for 300 years or 400 years of cutting down trees and taking away minerals and things like that. None of that is of concern anymore. What is of concern is that we treat each other exactly identical to one another, that we all get on that same playing field and we play exactly the same game. Well, the Iroquois game is not that mainstream game. And I'll be damned if I'll play it, and I will not participate in a process that looks past the real issues and tries to locate the difficulties and the frictions that we have between indigenous and non-indigenous peoples in this country in genetic material or in hidden personal practices. Thank you.
You've been listening to Dr. Roland Christjohn speaking on racism as an institutional phenomena, the Canadian experience. Recorded on November 6, 2000, at St. Thomas University in Fredericton. This is the Revolutionary Action Dance Party, produced out of CHSR-FM. To contact us, email rad@chsr.net or call area code 506-453-2000. 1-800-273-4985. I'm Pierre Loiselle. Thanks for listening.